I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There's a phrase in my family which has become a long-standing family joke called to moss things over, meaning to ruminate about and delay making decisions about things both big and small. Sometimes the waiting time is weeks, sometimes months, even years, and some of us are more afflicted with this condition than others. I was reminded of this when pulling the show together about waiting and patience in this hurried environment, especially at this busy time of year. Most of us feel we live in a world that's both sped up and slowed down. We can send a text message halfway around the globe in a second or two, while we also spend what feels like an inordinate amount of time sitting in traffic jams or waiting for our luggage at the airport carousel. Has our fast-paced existence made us more impatient? Have we forgotten the virtues of waiting? How has technology changed the rhythm and expectations of life? I'll put those questions to our guests. Sarah Schnichter is Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Baylor University, where she also does research on virtue and character development. Sarah Schnichter, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Jason Farman. He's Associate Professor and Director of the Design Cultures and Creativity Program at the University of Maryland, author of a book called Delayed Response, The Art of Waiting from the Ancient to the Instant World. And Jason Farman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Sarah, let me begin with you. Since I think many of us have forgotten how to be patient, what does it mean to be patient? How do we do that?
Well, when we talk about patience, it's about waiting calmly in the face of frustration, adversity, or suffering. So it's not just about waiting in lines, although that's very important. It's also about being calm when other people frustrate you, so with interpersonal relationships, and also about being able to withstand life hardships, so long-term illnesses or suffering of that sort. And so in our research, we've been trying to study what is patience and how do we cultivate it. And we find that there are a couple steps to being patient. So when I talk to folks, I like to talk about identify, imagine, and think. So first we want to identify the frustration or the emotion, the anger, whatever it is that we're feeling, and understand why that's happening, and then try to imagine a new way of thinking about the situation that can help us calm ourselves. And then we also talk about thinking with a bigger purpose. So if you're frustrated, it's a lot easier if you realize how this frustration is helping get you somewhere you want to be or helping you become a better person instead of just sticking in the moment.
And I do want to pick up on the think part, but let me get you in on the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Are we getting more impatient because of technology, because of our sped up world? Because it's interesting to think in our sped up world, you would think we wouldn't be so impatient. But help us understand the connection between the two.
Yeah, that was a question that initially drew me to this topic to begin with. I was imagining that our compressed time with technology, how we connect with one another through our mobile devices, has just shortened the time between sending and receiving messages, and even between the time between something we desire and getting that, whether that be doing a Google search for something you're curious about or even same-day shipping with Amazon. So I went back through the archives and began to look at the ways that technology has shaped our human experience of time. And what I ended up finding out was that people have felt this throughout history. Our feelings are not unique. Our technologies in each era shape our expectations of time and how that time is used and how we're connected through these technologies that bridge the gaps between people and ideas. And in each culture and in every era, we see that people are feeling this pull of acceleration, that the speed of life is getting faster and faster. And so we can see really similar feelings in eras, though I think there are some really unique things about our time, but there are a lot of similarities as well.
The idea that a couple hundred years ago, if a letter took 40 days to get across the country, that felt obviously had to do with expectations, but also felt like people waiting impatiently at the other end.
Yeah, so what we find is cognitively we are setting expectations as we relate to people and to technologies. Each technology sets its own expectations for how quickly it will respond. And so when somebody is sending a letter that takes 40 days, you anticipate that. And if it takes longer, that's when we begin to develop that impatience. So the time has compressed, but the cognitive processes behind it are really similar.
Does that make sense to you, Sarah?
It does. And we, as human beings, we habituate to things very quickly. So when something good happens to you, you get used to it and you want more. And I think as things speed up, and back in the past too, right, as we get used to an expectation very quickly, we want something better. So I think that's a classic human nature. Doesn't matter what time or in history you're at.
You talk about frustration, and it's frustration, what, with ourselves, with our expectations, with the other person that isn't responding quickly enough, Sarah?
Yeah, you know, I think it depends on the situation. We do find that some people tend to get more frustrated with other people, whereas others aren't struggling in that area as much, whereas some people get more frustrated when waiting in line, when stuck in traffic, and that seems to be a real trigger point, whereas others more struggle with those long-term life hardship struggles. And I think it probably depends on how you're approaching the situation and what kind of skills you have, what kind of empathy you have for others, how you're looking at things.
Jason, let me go back to you. And in your book, you talk about after World War II, when apartment buildings became more popular in cities, people had to wait for the elevator, and they did not right. like that. But the yes. The apartment, I guess, architects or builders came up with a novel way to make that wait less painful. Describe that for us.
Yeah, so as people began to wait, they dealt with this impatience for what was relatively a short period of time to wait for the elevator in office buildings or in apartment buildings in New York City, for example. So one building manager brought in engineers to try to solve the problem. How do we speed these elevators up? And they said it's an unsolvable problem. People are just going to have to wait. So in the building, there was a psychologist who was working in there and said, let me try a novel approach to this. So what he decided to do was to put up mirrors around the elevator lobby, and instantly the complaints stopped. And some people even applauded the building's manager for actually solving the problem and speeding the elevators up, because now what we had was people had something to do while they waited. They
admire their appearance
yes,
in the mirror.
That's right. Yeah, or other people. There was something to do. It was something to hold your attention for that brief period while you had to wait for the elevator, and that was enough to solve the problem.
Again, Sarah, does that make sense to you as a psychologist?
It does. We love to look at ourselves. It's not just children who are egocentric. It's adults as well. And, you know, I think we do it, too, with we talk about how technology erodes our patience, but sometimes technology actually facilitates us being patient. So now when people stand in line at the grocery store, what are they all doing? They're all on their phones.
Absolutely.
Talking to their friends. They're texting folks. They're reading interesting articles. So it's kind of that same type of thing of where's your attention? How are you focused in that situation? Is it focused on time or something else?
Well, Jason, again, going back to you and even going back to your book about, and these are more existential questions about what do we do with that time that we have on our hands? And is it that we're looking at our phone? Are we daydreaming? Are we fantasizing? I mean, it's an interesting thing to think about what that time means to us.
Yeah, I think that one of the questions and concerns that I look at in the book is why do we try to eliminate waiting from our lives, and what happens if we instead try to reposition our attitudes like toward it, very similar to what Sarah said at the beginning. So as we look at our phones in line, it is a strategy for dealing with our wait times, for occupying ourselves, but simultaneously we find that we are enormously busy and overtasked because we do feel the need and compulsion to constantly do something. So we're not just daydreaming, we're not studying our wait times, like becoming students of waiting, where we take that moment of time where we're really conscious of time. Waiting draws attention to time's passing in a way that productivity doesn't, or time where we're having fun. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is try to get people to think about how to study waiting, how to pay attention to it rather than eliminate it, and what are the costs of eliminating waiting from our lives in this contemporary moment.
In fact, you quote from a book called On Waiting, the author Harold Schweitzer says, our hatred of waiting may be a reaction to the existential crisis that all we might have in life is to watch time pass without our ability to do anything about it. And that really brought me up short, because that's a deeply existential idea.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think we run from waiting because we're confronted with those kinds of questions. What if life is simply about watching time pass?
Right.
And we don't want to confront those kinds of crises. We are confronted with some really deep questions when we face waiting, and some of those are very challenging to deal with. And that, I think, can be some of the fruitful aspects of waiting, is to study it, to look at it, to say, what can I learn about myself and my society in this moment of waiting? Why are we waiting, and who benefits from me waiting in this moment? How do people wait differently from each other? Those are some key questions.
And how do we think about ourselves here, our lives, who we are, the decisions that we have made in our life?
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting, too, that you bring this up, because in our research at Baylor, we are often looking to at how spirituality relates to patience and waiting. And right, as you talk about, it really is the deep existential questions that come about when you face waiting. Right. And suddenly, ooh, who am I? And what do I care about? And that's why when we talk about trying to cultivate patience, it's not just, oh, learning how to regulate your emotions in the moment. It's also getting more comfortable with that bigger life question and figuring out what your purpose is and being able to answer some of those existential questions is really what allows you to wait and even to suffer well.
To suffer. I do want to pick up on that. But do phones then distract us from these existential questions, Sarah?
I think sometimes they do. We never want to give a yes or no answer in psychology. I think sometimes they do distract us. And even though, yeah, it's easier to wait in the line at the grocery store, what am I missing out on? But I think our phones, it's not the technology that's the problem, that's how we use it. I think there are ways we can use our technology to help us dig deeper. Are there apps or products that could be developed that would help us in those moments to think about the deeper question instead of just going to your Facebook feed? Could you kind of go to an app that helps you prompt to do a meditation or to think about a big question in life? I think it's not the technology itself, but how we're choosing to use it as human beings.
And that's Sarah Schnichter, and she joins us along with Jason Farman. We are talking about waiting, the art of waiting. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about whether our fast-paced existence has made us more impatient. Have we forgotten about the virtues of waiting? And how has technology changed the rhythm and the expectations of life? And again, Jason Farman joining us. He's associate professor, director of the Design Cultures and Creativity Program at the University of Maryland, wrote a book called Delayed Response, The Art of Waiting from the Ancient to the Instant World. Sarah Schichter with us as well, and she's an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at Baylor University, and she does research on virtue and character development. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Jason, let me go back to you and go back to the chapter that you have in your book about pneumatic tubes in New York City and how that changed not just how people communicated with each other, but really how they related to each other.
Right. So in the 1890s, cities around the United States laid miles and miles of tube underground that would shoot these brass canisters filled with letters between post office departments. And this was alongside the dominant mail system of the time, which was a horse and wagon. So all of a sudden, people were able to get a letter to another person within an hour. And this ran all day long. People could send messages back and forth to each other. And it instantly felt like we were living in the future at this time, where we could connect with each other instantly in a way that we hadn't before, using this technology to keep in touch, just to send random notes throughout the day even. So the idea of instant messaging really was introduced. This was after the telegraph was introduced, but this technology was used by the everyday person to send a casual note, and it changed the pace of life and the rhythms of life, and it ran from the 1890s up through the mid-1950s before it was decommissioned. So it established a new sense of rhythm of how we kept in touch with each other, and ultimately changing the pace of life for these cities around the United States.
And we still use pneumatic tubes today. You have a photo, I guess, under the streets of New York, you know, right, with these, I guess, broken down pneumatic tubes, but nonetheless, a really fascinating photo.
Yeah, the pneumatic tube industry for some people is really thriving. In hospitals today, people are sending medical records or even blood samples around the hospital. It's the most efficient way to get things around a particular building. But right now, this mail tube system that was established in these cities is just sitting quietly unused. And now every time people are using infrastructures under these city streets to lay fiber optic cables, they're digging trenches anew and laying new infrastructure alongside these old infrastructures for keeping in touch.
Yeah, so interesting. Sarah, let's talk about being a patient parent. And I think any parent knows that children can test our patience. What are your suggestions, your ideas?
You know, I think being a patient parent is really a struggle. I have a 2.5-year-old at home. And
there you go.
I'm living this out every day. you know, I think with children, it's hard because they have such big emotions. Right? Their brains are at such a place that they can't regulate themselves yet, and they're learning how to do it. And so as a parent, I think the most important thing is to first have a grip of your own emotions, because if you get swept into the emotion of your child, it's just going to deteriorate very quickly, and everyone will be crying and screaming. Right? So I think as you're interacting with your child, right, 2.5-year-olds were having tantrums almost every day, right? It's identifying what your child is feeling and then what you're feeling and trying to soothe yourself. That way you can interact with your child and set boundaries and talk to them in a calm way and not have it come from your own reactivity. And just, I think with a parent too, you want to keep in mind that big picture of what you're trying to do. You're trying to create a person who's compassionate and kind and loving, and can get along with others. And realizing that every day it's going to be tough. You're going to do the same thing over and over again, but that there is a big picture in mind, and that what you do does matter for your child.
Is there a connection between patience and empathy, Sarah?
I think so. And we actually show that in our research. So patience is correlated with empathy, being able to understand someone else's emotions and realize what they're going through. It sometimes helps to say, yeah, I can understand why my child's upset. She's never encountered this before in the world, and this feels scary. And that helps to not get angry at what you see and understand why it's happening can really be useful.
Do you see that? Do you see that, Jason?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that building empathy through waiting is a really fundamental way of trying to deal with our emotions, like Sarah said, of the frustration and all of the anxiety and powerlessness that might accompany waiting. If we instead shift our perspectives on waiting to imagine it as an investment, it's a way of investing in other people, that we are standing in line behind that person who's trying to pay for their groceries with food stamps and cash and trying to get every coupon counted, but the line is growing increasingly frustrated. What we can do is imagine I'm standing here in line and that person is not robbing me of my time. Instead, I'm investing my wait times in their circumstances to say what they're dealing with is very different than what I'm dealing with. And I am invested in this social fabric to try to say, how do people wait differently and how can I identify that and try to empathize with it and imagine different social structures where time is more evenly distributed to people.
Well, does it also, though, create a kind of anxiety? Let's say you're standing in line, but you're also late to an appointment or late to picking up your kid at daycare.
Yeah. For me, as I look at these situations and I understand my own anxieties related to that person's anxieties, I try to understand the social structures that are making me feel anxious and rushed and hurried. Why are we living in certain social circumstances that dictate time differently? Part of the questions that I ask in the book is, to whose time are we supposed to be calibrated? Who are we supposed to be synced with? And I think identifying that is a really key question to identify how power is exercised in a society and also why we might feel so rushed in a day.
That's a lot of heady stuff to think about. Yeah. Let me put a question from Lynn. I'll put this to you, Sarah. She says, what's to stop us from saying hi to the person in line next to us? Picking up on this notion that if people are waiting in line together, feeling impatient, there are things to say and do.
So, you know, I think as you're waiting in line, you know, also piggybacking on what Jason was saying, can also be an opportunity to talk to someone new. To be curious about what's going on in the world and who is this other person that I can counter in real life. And, you know, I think research shows that some of our most enjoyable moments are just small conversations, even with strangers, and recognizing that maybe what matters is not just time, but people, and that encountering another person can really bless your day and find something new to learn.
You know, I was thinking as you were describing that about people, you know, I don't know if this happens anymore, but waiting in line for some Apple product. I mean, oftentimes waiting for hours and hours. I remember being at the Toronto Film Festival years ago, waiting sometimes 2 hours to see a movie. That's a long time to wait for a movie. But then you start talking to people who also love movies, and then you find out about their life, and then you talk about politics, and, you know, they ask you, why don't you have nationalized health care in the United States? And it goes on from there. So, there are good lines, and I guess there are bad lines.
Yeah. Right. I used to live in Pasadena, California, and waiting for the Rose Bowl to start was the all-night party. That was the fun part. And, like, the parade's wonderful, too, but you can enjoy the waiting, and there's something in that process that can be really meaningful and useful.
You agree, Jason?
Yeah, as you look at the tech industry's relationship to those kinds of things, like the Apple product launch is a really key way for the company to develop anticipation, which is a part of how we link with our products. In that wait time, as you know, these specs are released or photos are released of the new iPhone, you build excitement. And as you camp out overnight for the iPhone, that turns it into an event. And that event, the anticipation around it, builds that connection with that product. And we see that even if the product doesn't live up to those expectations, everything that leads up to that moment really builds a bond between a person and their product. So wait times are a key strategy for these companies to develop those links between people and their products.
And that's Jason Farman from the University of Maryland, author of a new book called Delayed Response, The Art of Waiting from the Ancient to the Instant World. Sarah Schichter with us as well, and she's Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Baylor University. A lot of comments here. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A comment from Alex says, the Uber pool has made me think about waiting differently in a car with a bunch of strangers. I end up in conversations I wouldn't otherwise have encountered. It's a nice way to fill that time that would usually be spent just waiting. An email from Kyle. Technology has absolutely increased the pace and stress of life. We need to surround ourselves with those who also respect calm, if that's what it is that we are looking for in our lives. A comment from Rick. The only thing we wait for now is Christmas. And that is true. Jason, let me go back to you. And another part of your book is also about letters sent and received during the Civil War. You write about a Joseph and Sarah Coryell. He's off fighting in the war. They're exchanging letters. Obviously, it takes weeks from one letter to arrive, and then the other letter is written back. He dies in war, but the letter that she receives is from him, written when he was alive. So there's this very strange moment that at that time he is alive to her, even though he is dead.
Right. So he died in combat in Fredericksburg, Virginia, about a month after the Battle of Fredericksburg, and had sent off this letter to her. And his last letter was, for me, this profound thing to come across, because it was really so kind of mundane and banal, just asking her to pay the bills and trying to maintain his connection to home and trying to be a part of home life, even though he had been separated from her for months. So the delay of these messages took essentially about 12 days for her to arrive after his death. So it takes these long delays for people to find out about their loved ones being killed in battle. And when those delays drag on even longer, people back home are left to interpret that silence. Has my husband passed away? Has he been killed in battle? So we interpret these time lags when we don't hear from our partners. And you see that over and over in these letters, people are explaining their lack of response. Mm-hmm. They're trying to put people at ease. I'm sorry I hadn't written. I know you were probably worried. We were marching and I had no way to write. So people are very conscious of the pace of connection in these letters.
And today, if we don't respond immediately to a text letter, a text message, then we're also apologizing for that too, Jason.
That's right. So as I studied this with the undergraduate students in North America, studying their response times, students tend to expect a response within about 5 to 10 minutes. And when it passes an hour and nobody has responded, they begin to get very worried and often very hurt by a lack of response. There's a phrase that called being left on read, which means that there's a little text message, it's been marked as read, and then they don't respond. And people get very hurt by that lack of response. So when you don't hear quickly, or at least within the time that you expect in that particular relationship, we're left to interpret it. And we often feel hurt or ignored, especially because that person has that device on them all day long and they're looking at it, but they're choosing not to respond to you.
And yeah, and why are they not responding to me? Sarah, again, do you want to respond to that? I think we've all experienced it.
Yes, and you see it especially in romantic relationships, especially newly budding ones. It's interesting how the dating scene has just changed dramatically. And in some ways, how much anxiety can be happening. When I look at my undergraduate students, that's a lot of pressure. And it's difficult. And we see some trends where young people today are having higher levels of anxiety and depressive symptoms and things of that sort. And I think part of it has to do with this constant social scrutiny and a sense of what's going on, how are people thinking about me, and you don't have someone there in real life to look at their emotional expressions, to look at their faces, and get a sense of what's actually happening, because some of that communication really is nonverbal, and we're just relying on messages that are or are not sent.
What about, though, anticipation? I'm thinking of the Carly Simon song, but nonetheless, this notion of waiting, Sarah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that waiting can be, in some ways, a really good thing, especially if it can be at kind of a desirable level of arousal. So when you're so distressed and, okay, now 3 hours have gone by and no one's responded, at that point you just start to give up. whereas I think we want to have this sense of anticipation, excitement, but it's all about where is that sweet spot for just the right amount of anxiety and kind of physiological arousal even, but not gone so far that someone just gives up and disengages from a relationship or a goal.
What do you think about anticipation, Jason?
There's a great quote from this book called A Lover's Discourse by Roland Barthes, and he asked the question, am I in love? Yes, because I'm waiting. So that is the lover's fatal identity, is the person who waits. And you see this in relationships today, that often when people make others wait, it's a claim to priority of time. So like Sarah said, these are really useful times, both in terms of the desire that they build for other people and kind of what we hope might come on the other side of our waiting, all the things that we might dream about. So waiting is this beautiful moment of anticipation of a different future. But also, if we study waiting in our own relationships, we can say, who is making me wait, and are they claiming a certain priority of time over my time? Is their time more valuable than mine? So it's a really useful thing to study in our own intimate relationships.
Well, and I'm thinking of, you say, I'll meet you at 6 o'clock and then for dinner or something, and then someone comes at 6:30. I mean, that is infuriating, Jason.
Yeah, yeah. So we see that in these relationships, people are ultimately trying to exercise communicate. They're trying to communicate a certain priority of time and power over these relationships, and we set standards. When I was in Tokyo, I was interviewing a lot of people around this statue of Hachiko, this dog that waited for its master, and people were gathered around this site waiting for others to arrive. It's a popular gathering site, and people were often late, and I asked people about that, and they said, you know, if people are not punctual, we don't see that as a positive personal characteristic, but if people keep in touch with us throughout their journey, if they're updating us, if they're giving us feedback, then we feel, okay, I'm willing to wait. But if I don't hear anything and all of a sudden you're a half hour late, that to me, I look down on your own ability to manage your time, and that is a personal insult.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jason Farman. He's Associate Professor, Director of the Design Cultures and Creativity Program at the University of Maryland, author of a book called Delayed Response, The Art of Waiting from the Ancient to the Instant World. Sarah Schichter with us as well, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Baylor University. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Sarah Schnitger and Jason Farman about patience and waiting. Let me read an email from Pete. He says, I notice where folks are really impatient is at yield and stop signs. I would add red lights. Not sure if this is true impatience or something else. Can I toss that to you, Jason?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about red lights is that we can simultaneously imagine it as something that allows modern society to work and function. We have to wait in order for others to go, and others will have to wait for us to go. So we can realize that our wait times are an investment in that social requirement of modern life. Simultaneously, we're really unsure of often how these function within a city. Often they might be thrown off by weather, they might be misaligned, and so we feel frustrated when we hit every single red light as we're driving to work or whatnot. And so there are these really complex structures behind the scenes that people aren't really given access to. We're not really afforded the ability to know the complexity of these systems. And so all we can do is wait and hope that we're waiting in a way that is useful for others, but sometimes we feel that it's more frustrating than it is beneficial.
But that is no excuse to run a red light or to run a stop sign. Right, Jason?
Yeah, absolutely. That's violating that social contract of waiting, that ultimately we will both wait, and that's going to allow us to move forward in life.
I mean, it's dangerous, just to underscore what I'm trying to say here. Sarah, anything you want to add to that? It's one of my pet peeves, which is why I was underscoring that. Sarah, any thoughts?
Yeah, when I think too, you know, we get caught up in our own busyness and forget about the bigger picture of safety for all. I think it's interesting when you look at kind of ancient texts around the virtue of patience, they talk about on the one extreme is recklessness and kind of the anger and patience, but on the other extreme is a term they call acedia, which is both busyness and sloth at the same time. So we just get caught in these little minor things and forget the importance of the bigger picture, that we all need to be safely getting home and that death can happen. If I just choose to run that red light, because I just wanted to get home faster.
Sure. Sarah, you have mentioned suffering a couple of times about patients. Help us understand what you're talking about.
You know, I think, well, it's interesting, the word patience comes from the Latin root, which means to suffer. It's really etymologically part of that term. And when you talk about suffering, it can be a major suffering or a minor suffering, but it's willingness to carry that burden of something you don't want to carry for the sake of someone else, whether it be kind of society in a broader scale, or for an individual other. That willingness to take on the burden of waiting, of suffering, of doing something that maybe isn't your ideal life condition, but you do it because there's something important that you need to achieve.
I'm thinking, Jason, taking what Sarah is saying there, but being a little bit more concrete about it, which is sometimes you're waiting for something you think will make you happy. Sometimes you're waiting for a diagnosis. It might be scary, and that's a different kind of waiting.
Yeah, I agree. I think that etymological root is fascinating, and to imagine the relationship between wait times and patience and suffering is really fruitful, I think, and insightful. I think we always hope that our wait times will be worth it. We hope that it is an investment. And when we feel disconnected from that relationship between our time and it's serving some kind of function, that's when we feel a bit powerless, especially in those kinds of those moments where we're waiting in anticipation for something that we can't rush, we can't speed up the process, and we feel very powerless in that situation. We hope then to alleviate that stress by imagining that it is an investment of some kind that ultimately it will lead to the outcome that we hope that comes on the other side of waiting, and that is a particular kind of suffering, especially when we're disconnected from the agency over speeding up time and arriving at what we hope for.
Sarah, do good things come to people who wait?
They seem to. Our research would suggest the answer is yes. So people who wait, being able to wait well, to be patient, is correlated with more life satisfaction, more hope, more self-esteem, positive emotions, lower depression symptoms, and even better goal achievement. So it seems that, yes, waiting does actually bring good things in the long term.
And that really is in many ways about delaying gratification, right?
It is. And I think sometimes, you know, one difference, though, is delay of gratification, you often have a choice, whereas sometimes in life you don't have choices. As Jason was saying, you don't have that sense of agency. So sometimes you need to wait, even if you don't know what's going to happen, you're still having hope and trusting that something good will happen.
Let me read an email from Stuart. He says, at Disney in Florida 5 years ago, we waited in many lines and got to chat with other parents and commiserate about lines and waiting. This year, it felt as if there was no one to talk to because everyone in line had their phones out to entertain themselves and their kids, still waiting but busy doing other things. We did not pull out our phones and tried to talk to our impatient six-year-old about the scenery, etc. But that's an interesting observation. Jason, your thoughts?
Yeah, that to me is a really key shift that's happening, is that we are allowed to not wait throughout the day. So if we are ever to become students of waiting and to find value in it, we need to actually embrace it. We need to find these moments of putting the technology away and to say, okay, in this moment, instead, I'm going to wait, and we're going to use this as a time to find out what comes of this kind of waiting. Disney is a really interesting example because they have to deal with waiting in order to deal with their customer satisfaction. So at the beginning of these lines that people enter, you'll often have designs that show how long your wait is going to be, and they almost always overestimate those times. So it'll show your wait time is going to be 2 hours, and then if you get to the front of the line in an hour or 90 minutes, you actually leave the experience with a positive feeling rather than a negative one because you beat expectations. Now, what we do in that line, on the other hand, is really up to us, and we need to figure out how to wait and how to wait in productive ways.
Here's a tweet from Jay. Patience is the easiest of the virtues. Remembering that helps me when I'm feeling impatient with others. Is patience the easiest of the virtues, Sarah?
I don't know. know about that. Not for me. People seem to struggle with it, actually.
Because it's hard.
I study patience and they say, oh, I have none of that. No one says that about other virtues. No one says, oh, I'm not grateful or I'm not loving.
So there's a kind of virtue in impatience. Are you saying that?
Yes, I think so. I think in some situations in our culture, people see impatience as a virtue, which I think is mistaken and not a great thing for us as a people.
Because it says we're a busy, important person.
Right. I think it's interesting, too, going back to the waiting in line and with your children. We were talking about how to be a patient parent and how to teach your children to be patient. Something that I think is really a struggle as a parent, I try not to ever bring out that phone for my 2.5-year-old. Because I think it's important to teach people young that you can use your imagination. You can find fun things to do that don't just involve being entertained. But boy, it's hard because it's easier for me in the moment if I just bring that phone out and turn a show on. But finding moments to really teach my child how to cultivate her own emotion regulation, there's lots of moments, but choosing to do it is a challenge.
No question. Jason, I want to talk to you for a bit, and then we got some more comments here about when we see a slow-moving short line or a fast-moving long line. Mm-hmm. What is the process that we go through in deciding which is the best line for us?
I think we choose wrong every time. I don't think that we ever find... Yeah, it does, yeah. We're just trying to imagine based on what we perceive to be the fastest route to where we're going. And often this mirrors our experience of downloading something on the internet or even on your phone. If it appears to be moving quickly at the beginning and then stalls at the end, that is a very frustrating process. So designers will often front-load things to slow it down at the beginning and then speed it up at the end so we leave with a positive experience. So often when you're jumping over to that fast line and then it crawls for the rest of the way and then you watch everybody pass you in the other line, that is a very frustrating process than instead sticking out the slow line that speeds up at the end.
Jason, any ideas for how to make boarding an airplane less onerous?
No. I think, a lot of it is about feedback, though, that we're often given these situations where we are not told when our waiting will end. And often the delays shift in time and our expectations have to shift along with it. So I think it's about, in terms of customer experience, it is about being able to be transparent with the customers to give them a very clear sense of when their waiting will end and keep them apprised of that throughout the process, as opposed to something like a buffering icon as you're trying to load a video. It just spins and you don't know when it's going to end, and it holds your attention, but it ultimately gets frustrating at the end.
Let me read a tweet from Brandon. Playing music in an orchestra involves long waits before one arrives at their parts. Musicians being present while waiting versus sneaking out a phone improves cohesion of the whole piece. Sarah, that's an interesting perspective on waiting if you're part of an orchestra and waiting to play your part.
I think that's an excellent insight. Waiting's about staying engaged still and not just exiting mentally from the moment. And I think musicians really do have to cultivate that patience, that timing, that sense of engagement, even when you're not actively doing something, because you are a part of that larger group. I think that's a wonderful example of how we can learn to be patient in this world.
Well, and actors have to do the same thing, waiting for to speak their lines. Jason, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Yeah, Orson Welles had a great quote that, a lack of constraint is the enemy of art. So waiting is a type of constraint, and you have to work within those kinds of constraints. And waiting also allows us to daydream. And daydreaming unlocks what's often called the default network of our cognitive process that is often called the imagination network, where you will come across ideas and certain creative capacities through the act of daydreaming. That's only unlocked in those moments of waiting and boredom and daydreaming, or standing in the shower, not being stimulated stimulated by all of these technologies is when often we'll come up with some really fantastic and creative ideas. And if we eliminate waiting, if we pull out that phone in the orchestra, for example, we are not giving ourselves the capacity to tap into that default network of creativity that will unlock new ways of thinking, of new innovations on ideas and knowledge.
Sarah, is there a connection between health, physiological health, and patience?
There is. We find that people who are patient, right, their physiological system is less reactive. They can stay calm and not have that constant stressor on their physiology, and that's an important thing for long-term health. And, you know, to that default network that Jason was talking about, that's also the network, those times of waiting and daydreaming are so important for the development of empathy and perspective taking and love and kindness and compassion, that we need those moments of reflection, not only to calm our own physiology, but to find a way to be pro-social and good citizens of our community, that we must have these times of quiet.
Jason, I'm curious about how you got interested in, we've been talking about patience, impatience, but also waiting, the art of waiting, as is the subtitle of your book.
I was thinking about this past week, actually, and realized a connection that I hadn't made up until a couple of days ago. When I was an undergraduate studying literature in Santa Barbara, California, my professor at the time asked us as a class to make check marks next to any passage or any moment in a text where we got bored. And I found that to be a really interesting method. She says you can learn a lot from your boredom. And that has stuck with me, and I hadn't thought about it till last week. And where that led to in my own work is when I started teaching undergraduate students. This was about 12 years ago, and I noticed that they were sending about a couple of hundred text messages in a given day. And this was extraordinary to me. I had not really been an avid texter, and I was curious, you know, and I asked them, why do you text instead of call somebody? Why don't you connect with them in real time? Why do you choose a medium that makes you wait and potentially makes you bored as you wait? So thinking about these technologies that make us wait, make us bored, and kind of linking that back to what my professor had said, you can learn a lot from your boredom. All of those led me down this path to think about how technologies have us wait at particular moments, and that ultimately shapes our intimate relationships, how we develop knowledge and share knowledge across distances, and how we can understand societal structures and power.
Are you less bored?
I'm finding that boredom is really useful for me. So I try to embrace boredom as often as possible. I don't flee from it. I try to find those moments where I can try to embrace it rather than pull out my phone. It's a challenge, though. I mean, I love my technology. I love my phone. And so it's been, you know, I've written about mobile media for quite a while and love mobile technology. It's really hard to keep the phone in my pocket. But when I do, I'm a happier person by far.
Well, we are going to end on that note. And my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Jason Farman, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And again, he's associate professor and director of the Design Cultures and Creativity Program at the University of Maryland. He's got a new book called Delayed Response, The Art of Waiting from the Ancient to the Instant World. Sarah Schnitger joined us from Baylor University, where she is associate professor of psychology and neuroscience, And Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.